supposed to be by Jose Ronzon Leon at the Autonomous Metropolitan University of Mexico. He is unable to make it due to important political developments in his country. As many of you know, on September 26, 43 students at Ayotzinapa Teachers College near Acapulco were abducted en route to a protest in Iguala, and almost certainly murdered and incinerated by a drug cartel on orders of the mayor of Iguala and his wife. And this event has highlighted the corrupt collusion between the government of Mexico and drug cartels, and has sparked a major protest movement in Mexico City. A national day of work stoppages and protests is planned for this coming Thursday, November 20th. And if you think this has nothing to do with us here, I urge you to read Ruben Martinez's op-ed in the LA Times Saturday about how the U.S. is implicated in Mexico's violence. Also, for those of you who are into social media, check out on Twitter the hashtag YaMeCanse, I'm tired, YaMeCanse, which will give you updates on this nascent protest movement. And in Professor Ronzon Leon's place, Luis Alberto Aviles has graciously stepped in to read Professor Ronzon Leon's talk.
Thank you. This is a picture of Jose Ronzon Leon. I was in communication with him last week. And he was quite troubled because it was very difficult for him to leave the country when his university was under strike, when he was part of the negotiating team. And I asked him a couple of things about what was going on. And before starting his talk, I'm going to say only one more thing about the situation. Jose was talking to the students, saying the difficulties of closing the universities, of the university, of going into strike, because of the academic consequence, because even to the economic consequence for the people, for the vendors on the streets around, and for many other purposes, many other reasons, including the possibilities of violence. And he says something to the students that actually struck me as an important thing that we all professors should have in mind. He said, if you're going to take the risk of joining a strike, be sure that you do it in such a way that is worth it. I think that it's important as educators that we understand that our social role is not only a matter of academic transmission of knowledge, but also to accompany people who are working towards social justice. So having said that, let me start. Here I present, and I really like Mariola's presentation. It's somewhat different to what Jose has to say, and they complement really well. The ports of Veracruz and Havana in the second half of the 19th century. Jose is focusing on regional links in population, epidemics, and health policy. Here you can see the port of Havana, the port of Veracruz, and also the port of Louisiana. And there was a constant trade between these three cities. The centuries-old practice of public health was inherently linked to the development of ports, commerce, and urban settlements. Since this year, APHA annual meeting takes place in the port city of New Orleans, it is important to take a critical look at the historical relation of ports and public health. This presentation aims to show the links between the ports of Veracruz and Havana in the second half of the 19th century. These ports are presented in terms of their geographical and urban conditions. This presentation addresses the complex healthcare landscape in these seaport urban settlements that historically suffer from poor health. So I need to make a few necessary historical explanations in order to understand the situation of Veracruz and Havana. Since colonial times, the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean area played a major role in the shaping of the political, economic, and cultural space of what has been now called the Great Atlantic. This importance was based mainly on the fact that the Caribbean area was the first frontier of the Spanish possessions in the New World. Early on, the ports were the object of urban policies that led to the development of their shape and consolidation as cities that were able to host a diverse population, Spanish, indigenous, and blacks. and as an important node for economic activities. These two features led to King Philip II of Spain to order that port settlements should follow a grid plan, with a central square, parish, churches, convents, schools, houses, plus wineries, shops, and warehouses. The latter were essential for the function of that ports played in the regional and intercontinental trade between the Old and the New World. As the ports of the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean increased the circulation of products, both for commerce and the corresponding contribution to sustain the finances of the Spanish monarchy, they were to become objects of the Spanish crown enemy attacks. Therefore, these cities were subjected to a defensive military policy, which was expressed in the construction of forts and garrisons. The construction of defense military complexes, castles, bastions, magazines, dockyards, gunners, and walls, was a task that required a lot of time and a lot of economic investment. By the late 18th century, most of the ports of the region were surrounded by walls and exhibited the grid plan, the grid urban plan that was still present at the end of the 19th century. Let me show you a few pictures here of that grid plan and the walls surrounding the city. This is the case of Veracruz in the 18th century. You can see here Havana, and you can see too the walls around the city. And again, the grid plan. And some contrast with New Orleans, although to some extent it has some degree of a grid plan, there are no walls surrounding the city. However, those urban settlements had to face their geographical and climate conditions, as they were located in the tropics. Weather was a factor that made them inhospitable places for people unaccustomed to cope with high temperatures, humidity, and mosquitoes as disease vectors. So they were basically spaces of disease. Since the arrival of the first explorers, conquerors, and colonizers, the common denominator of the ports of the Gulf and the Caribbean region was that they were almost unfit for human development. Foreigners began to experience illnesses that they did not know, and natives faced unknown diseases that were not known in the New World. The region experienced difficult times marked by the presence and proliferation of diseases which acquired the status of epidemics throughout the Gulf and the Caribbean region, extending inland in the Americas and even infecting the interior parts of the continent. The diaries and chronicles of travelers, scientists, businessmen, or visitors describe the region as a spaces of death due to the disease that plagued these areas, such as cholera, plague, smallpox, malaria, and yellow fever. All these made the Gulf and Caribbean area to show a two-faced region. One face revealed increased commerce and economic development. The other face revealed death, dying, and human suffering due to the proliferation of infectious diseases. There were two processes that took place among the countries of the region, especially among Mexico, the United States, and Cuba. First, there was an intensification and consolidation of trade links. And second, the ports located in this region became repositories of highly contagious diseases. That was the case of Veracruz, which was even called the City of Death. Due to the horrific scenes encountered by travelers who trod its streets, and Havana, that became notorious since arriving at its ports was enough to catch the prevailing disease. The ports of Havana and Veracruz were two of the main ports on the route of the Atlantic trade. Havana was referred to as the key to the Novo Hispanic trade, and Veracruz, the sea gate of the Viceroyalty of New Spain. This binomial port was a transit route for diseases such as yellow fever in both settlements. This disease has been a veritable scourge. And here's, for example, the death recorded in Cuba from 1900 to 1906. And as we epidemiologists know, what is always recorded is just a minimum part of what actually occurs in these places. Its presence in the Mexican coastline became endemic, and every year, mostly during the summer, it proliferated more often. Here you can see the case of in Cuba again. I guess that more deaths in Havana were too because of the increased population, let's say, because of the size of population in Havana as opposed to other places. But you can see that they remain fairly stable, the death from this infection, from yellow fever, in Havana and other provinces. And in the case of Veracruz, you can see a seasonal pattern here, very pronounced and very consistent through the years. In July, August, September, the peak of death. Well, there were some measures and policies of cooperation between Mexico and Cuba that were implemented at the end of the 19th century. The year with the highest incidence of numbers of deaths in Veracruz was 1899, when a record of 595 victims was reached. This led the Mexican government to promote programs that will help eradicate the yellow fever, and the campaign called Defense Against Yellow Fever was born. The Mexican Commission was headed by Dr. Eduardo Lisiaga and other physicians. The commission determined that the presence of the disease was related to two main factors. One, the unsanitary hygienic conditions of the port city and its environment. And two, the contagion and transmission from port to port. It was a known fact that the Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean integrated a region that suffered from the same diseases. Yellow fever was one of those evils, both to Mexico, to the south coast of the United States, especially New Orleans, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, and Central America. At meetings, such as those of the American Public Health Association, which was active before 1900, and other regional conferences, health professionals, mainly physicians, analyzed the situation to adopt preventive measures to tackle the unsanitary conditions of these port cities. Mexico and Cuba were among the most active members of this collaboration and discussion, and always, many of the participants talk about the cases of Veracruz and Havana. They were constantly discussed. The case of Veracruz deserves special attention, and Dr. Lisiaga moved to that port city to observe the action of sanitizing and cleaning the urban environment. These actions included the port redevelopment that was in charge for several private companies, but most significantly, the Whitman Pearson Company. The works consisted in the demolition of the walls and bastions of the city, expansion of the city onto the sea, creating a new bay, renovating and expansion of roads, destruction of all colonial houses, and construction of drains and draining of swamps that surrounded the city. These actions also contained measures and collaboration and cooperation of Mexico with neighboring countries and islands, especially Cuba. Thus, it was determined that the Mexican delegation, led by Eduardo Lisiaga, visit the port of Havana. The goal of the visit was to observe the initiative that was taking place there. Mexican officials were able to meet the Cuban research bacteriologist, Carlos Finlay, who identified the vector that transmitted the yellow fever, the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Under this scenario, and with strong and forceful influence of the research made in Havana, the port city of Veracruz started to implement a few measures to combat yellow fever with an initiative formally launched in 1901, but actually it started to be implemented in 1903 when definite steps were taken. And you can see how before 1903 there was an increase in the number of total deaths, and then after this collaboration with Cuba, there was a dramatic decrease of deaths in the city of Veracruz. In Veracruz, the crusade, based on epidemiological contributions of Carlos Finlay, the Cuban researchers, followed the approach with a certain elements. First, isolation of suspected patients. Two, spraying houses. Three, destroying the breeding grounds for the mosquitoes. And four, providing a domestic medical training to doctors who will work in the central city square. This work also coincided with the culmination of what has been called the port works. In 1902, Mexico President Porfirio Díaz came to the port of Veracruz and inaugurated the new face of the port, the new man-made bay, as well as the destruction of the walls and most of its nine bastions. But there was a turning point. the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution marked many things in Mexican history, in terms of public health and hygiene policy, for example. But in the control of yellow fever in coastal areas, it represents a real dramatic turning point. New partnerships with other countries were no longer actively promoted. This initiative, which at the time were embedded in a broad and encompassing project of modernization, suffered a breakdown. The implementation of health regulations were derailed. Health institutions, such as hospitals, were deteriorated. Health workers failed to implement the established controls at entry points of access to the country, and they were unable to continue collaborative efforts with other countries. The political turmoil of the Mexican Revolution created unstable conditions that made sanitary policies difficult to implement. And this is the final comment to wrap up this history that Jose is presenting to us. This historical process of regional linkages between two port cities of the Gulf of Mexico highlights shared problems and points to essential international collaboration to prevent the spread of contagious diseases. Somehow, in Veracruz, the health goals were partially achieved, at least in numerical terms, and also in reshaping the urban environment. However, there were critical limitations that account for a limited success. Beyond the walls of the city of Veracruz, a marginal population was growing, and yellow fever and other contagious diseases were recorded. These epidemics were never adequately controlled and resurfaced when the health system collapsed in the initial years of the battles of the Mexican Revolution. The control of epidemics in port cities is never a matter of technical interventions, the provision of medical services, or sanitation policy. The history of epidemics is also the history of marginal populations. A public health mandate should be to avoid marginality in the first place.
Thank you, and we'll thank Jose in absentia. Okay, so today, for our last talk, we're going to turn from the global to the local. We're here in an American port city that has, of course, been critical to the economic development of the U.S. You may not know this, but the whole reason that it became part of the U.S., that we bought Louisiana from the French, was to buy New Orleans. And it has been not coincidentally plagued by special health challenges from yellow fever, which we've heard about, to contemporary challenges from including hurricanes, oil spills, and chronic health conditions. And it is to this local story that we will now turn last as we hear from Craig Colton, the Carl O. Sauer Professor of Geography at Louisiana State University. For the past several years, he's been heading up the community resilience component of the GC Harms Project, which is responding to the Gulf Coast oil spill, in conjunction with the University of Texas Medical Branch. He's the author of the award-winning book, which I urge you to get, An Unnatural Metropolis, Wrestling New Orleans from Nature, and the newly published book, Southern Waters, The Limits of Abundance. The title of Professor Colton's talk is Oil Spills and Community Resilience.